Glenn Hauser welcoming you to Candler Media 0504. Recorded April 26, 2005. COM is about media around the American continent, not especially shortwave, and is made possible by Universal Radio for quality, amateur, and shortwave equipment. For a catalog, call 1-800-431-3939 or check their website, www.universal-radio.com. And Universal also sponsors DXing.com for much more information, including an archive of our DX listening digests and an audio file of this program. Let's begin with an interesting idea by Will Martin in St. Louis, who says, I've been kicking this around for some time, an antenna or antenna system specifically designed to be used with portable shortwave radios while they're being used as a real portable, that is, while walking around and being carried. For many years, I've exercised by walking. Sometimes I listen to local AM or FM via a headphone radio, but I would many times rather listen to shortwave because local radio often has nothing worth listening to. But it's actually terribly difficult to listen to shortwave while moving around, mainly because the whip antenna on portable shortwave sets is awkward and intrusive. You really have to hold the radio in your hand and constantly move and maneuver so that the antenna avoids being snagged on tree branches or otherwise gets in the way and is subject to damage. Ideally, you'd have the shortwave radio in a belt pouch or fanny pack, wear headphones, and have both hands free. But doing this with a whip antenna sticking out of that carrier always presents problems, with the whip getting in your way or catching on something you go by. And of course, having a whip sticking up looks silly if you care about appearance. I have many different portable radios, and using them with just the whips usually produces poor and noisy reception. That's why I have and use a tiny antenna. But trying to use a tiny antenna itself in this mode is also pretty unrewarding. It works best when the clip on the end is fastened to some other metal that acts as an antenna extension, and by itself works best when stretched out vertically. Just trying to use it as the radio's antenna while draped over your shoulder or the like doesn't work, and the open circuitry of the tiny antenna's circuit board is subject to damage if used portably, such as jammed in a pouch along with the radio. What I've been wondering about is the application of advanced technology such as that being used for surface-mounted antennas on spacecraft and aircraft, where the antenna itself is physically small but electrically large. Maybe some nondescript encapsulated flat packet that clips to your collar or other parts of your clothing with a wire that runs to the external antenna jack of the shortwave radio and which provides a high-level signal comparable to a 10-meter chunk of wire or the like. Is that possible? A low-noise active antenna unit with low power consumption to provide good quieting on relatively weak shortwave signals and be of minimal size may well be a contradiction in terms, but technology has performed miracles before. So Will is asking for people on the DX Listening Digest group or others, some ham radio or shortwave discussion groups, to see if the technology exists and could be made into a marketable product at an acceptable price. He says, I'm sure there is a market, not only for this specific mobile use, but also for the many owners of shortwave portables who don't want any wires hanging off them, or whose wives don't want the wires. Maybe the antenna unit could be a direct plug-in unit that could attach to the side of the radio, or be used with an intervening wire as an alternate. Maybe we can get some input from engineers that work on military electronics and might have ideas to share. Thanks to Mike Cooper, Artie Bigley, and Mike Terry for an article from the March 13th Atlanta Journal-Constitution about another unusual antenna, Slinky Turns 60 by Don Fernandez. A spiraling legacy has fascinated and frustrated Lestine Lewis for decades. 40 years after that first encounter, her quandary still remains. Just how do you get a Slinky to step down the stairs? The Slinky, inducted into the National Toy Hall of Fame in 2001, is about 63 feet of coiled steel. How many toys get their own stamp, after all? The U.S. Postal Service commemorated Slinky in February 1999. On the surface, there's only one twist to a Slinky. Let the coil fall down descending levels and watch gravity make it move. Dan Bova, deputy editor for Stuff magazine, which tracks cutting-edge gear and devices, says it's the same reason people like Paris Hilton, People like brainless things that move funny. It doesn't need batteries, which parents like. It doesn't make noise, which parents like. It's just the simplicity of the thing. But the applications have expanded. Many schools use Slinky to illustrate and study wave and motion analysis. And Slinkies were employed in many classrooms to demonstrate how aftershocks from the tsunami that struck Southeast Asia reverberated through Europe. The first generation of Slinkies were constructed from carbon steel, which would often rust, not the best quality, in a flexible toy. The steel used now is galvanized. Upscale Slinkies are forged from brass for $20, covered in 14-karat gold plate for $100, and molded from sterling silver for $400. But aside from safety crimps added to the ends, the design remains the same, and the basic model is only $2.99. Ah, here's the good part. Who says Slinky is strictly low-tech? Jim Shields of Stone Mountain, Georgia, says the metal Slinky is often used as an antenna for shortwave radio listeners. There are sites on the net that manufacture antennas using Slinkies. I've used one for a couple of years. Slinkies even went to war in Vietnam, where soldiers would drape them in the trees as radio antennas. And no ode to Slinky would be complete without mentioning the commercial jingle. Perhaps no toy is more associated with a theme song composed in the 1960s, an infectious ditty that just screams for a sing-along. Well, pardon me if I only read the lyrics. Everyone knows it's Slinky. What walks downstairs, alone or in pairs, and makes a slinkety sound? A spring, a marvelous thing. Everyone knows it's Slinky. It's Slinky, it's Slinky. For fun, it's a wonderful toy. It's Slinky, it's Slinky. It's fun for a girl and a boy. It's fun for a girl and a boy. No, I really have no idea how the tune goes. And this comes from Joe Buck in Delaware. As the cassette tape slinks slowly below the western horizon, and most new autos no longer offer cassette tape players, it has become harder for us to enjoy shortwave programming while hurtling down the expressway. The cassette-type adapters we once used to connect our portable radios to the car audio system will soon have no hole to plug into. GM has come to the rescue by introducing an auxiliary audio input mini jack on the dash of some 2006 models. Now you can connect the earphone jack of your shortwave radio or MP3 player directly to the car's audio system. This assumes GM will still be in business by 2006. Also that there will still be some shortwave programming worth listening to in 2006, and signal levels from off-pointed transmit antennas will still be sufficient to overcome highway power line noise and BPL pollution by that time. Quoting from a bit of the GM press release, radios featuring the new aux input jack will debut starting in late spring. There'll be standard equipment on 2006 models of the Chevy HHR, Impala, and Monte Carlo, Saturn VUE and ION, Pontiac Solstice, Buick Lucerne, and Cadillac DTS. The radios will be fitted to other new GM models over the next several years. Bill Smith in Iowa has some bad news. Camel's Head about to enter the tent, something called cognitive radio. He found this in an FCC report and order. Number 05-57A1 will include an exact link to it on the FCC website, but deep inside the report, paragraph 22 says, "We propose to allow unlicensed devices that employ cognitive radio technologies to operate at higher power in rural and other areas with limited spectrum use. While we are not adopting any changes to allow higher power operation by unlicensed devices, we continue to believe that cognitive radio technologies hold great promise to allow such higher power operation without interference to other spectrum users. We expect to further consider the issue at a later date. The rules recognize divergent perspectives on software-defined radios. Some wish to adopt the U.S. Department of Defense standards, while others prefer more of an open-source, new radio approach." That's GNU. See www.gnu.org/software/new-radio. Finally, software radio has promises of offering applications such as dynamic spectrum sharing, interruptible spectrum sharing, and rapidly reconfigurable secondary markets in spectrum use will be attainable with cognitive radios. From the Spring 2005 newsletter of KCCU Public Radio in Lawton, Oklahoma, General Manager Mark Norman says there are new interference problems for car and home radios. Did you know if you're charging your cell phone while driving in your car, you can often hear a buzz or a cycling hum while the phone is charging? If you hear this, just unplug the charger on your phone to determine if it goes away. You can charge your phone at home or when you're not listening to the radio. Another problem, satellite radios from XM or Sirius installed in a car in an aftermarket situation use a small FM transmitter built into the radios to broadcast a signal into your FM radio from within your own car. This causes major problems for several reasons. That was in caps. First, XM and Sirius have used the lower end of the FM dial to broadcast their signals to your original equipment radio on 87.9, 88.1, 88.5, 88.7, or 88.9. What this means is that when you turn on your satellite radio, you cannot hear the FM stations like KCCU on the bottom end of the dial. I was in a Ford truck with an XM, where this problem wiped out all of the stations on the car radio, except for the very strongest high-power FM station. The only solution is to make sure your satellite radio is turned off if not being used. Just switching or trying to switch to FM will not stop the interference. The satellite radio must be turned off. We hope new radios with satellite and HF built into the factory-installed radios will solve this problem. And one more, it has been found that the new stoplights, set to sense when a car stops at an intersection, send out an RF noise. It can cause your radio to fade or buzz at a stoplight, yet work fine when you're driving. You can sometimes count the clicks as the lights change. Another article in the same newsletter talks about KCCU's imminent conversion to HD radio, that is, digital sidebands, not realizing that that in and of itself will start causing greater interference to neighboring stations. Although I don't actually have a DRM receiver, I have been picking up some signals which just sound like a buzz on an analog receiver. During the HFCC meeting in Mexico City in February, I picked a DRM test up on the 11-meter band, which apparently no one else did that I know of, at a distance. It was Radio Educación on 25620. I was able to observe some interesting things about it despite not actually demodulating the digital signal and reported it previously. This prompted one reply I've received so far from Kevin Ryan, who's with the website www.radioeng.co.uk. He says the 12-second fading periodicity, I heard, is 10 times the duration of what is termed the multiplex superframe, which has a duration of 1.2 seconds. The superframe is made up of three frames of 400 millisecond duration. The symptoms you describe may be a function of applying energy dispersal algorithms to the data stream, or it could also be a function of the audio being encoded. He says, I'm used to watching the DRM waveform on a spectrum analyzer display, so I've never experienced the phenomena you describe. I've seen the DRM spectrum become lopsided on many occasions before returning to the more familiar flat-top spectrum. Thanks to Claudio Morales in Argentina for posting to the Conexión Digital list an article from Trabajadores Digital, a Cuban publication. It's in Spanish, and I'm just going to translate and excerpt a few bits of it. It's titled The C-130 Flying Menace by Joaquin Oramas, originally appeared in the Cuban government paper, aren't they all, Granma Internacional. The C-130 aircraft is a dangerous provocation announced by the President of the U.S. to be used for flying near Cuban territorial waters as a means of transmitting the signals of the poorly named TV Marti to the island. Washington's plan is to carry out the transmission of TV Marti from a C-130 aircraft especially equipped, costing $70 million, not including the cost of maintenance or crews. Goes on to talk about how the same aircraft has been used for U.S. aggression in various other places, such as Vietnam, Afghanistan, and Iraq. It's a grave menace for the security of the island of Cuba. According to some specialists, it would be accompanied by two high-speed fighters near Cuban territorial waters. What would happen if the plane suffered an accident or some other dangerous situation? Here's the key sentence in this. The C-130 could be the Maine of the 21st century. The sinking of the Maine in 1898 was the excuse for the Spanish-American War in Havana Harbor. There's a lot more to this long article. You can read it all if you understand Spanish. DX Listening Digest 5063 at worldofradio.com. And in the summary for this edition of Continent of Media 0504, also at worldofradio.com, you'll find links for further reading about all the subjects mentioned. If you have something to contribute or a comment, always glad to hear from our listeners. World of Radio or Continent of Media, P.O. Box 1684, ENID OK 73702 USA, or WORADIO at yahoo.com. Before we leave Cuba, another interesting little tidbit which appeared on the ABDX list from someone known as Tony in Miami. Believe it or not, there's a difference in something as subtle as Cubans that live in Cuba now and those like my parents who exiled themselves 40 years ago. Even words used are different, such as the expression okay. My parents, and as I was taught, say it just like you say it in English, okay. However, by the time communism took over, the anti-Americanism was so much that they Cubanized it so that they say oka in Spanish. Also, we say señor and señora, but they use compañero and compañera, the communist term comrade. Although I listened to a lot of CBC shows from Canada, what I was not accustomed to hearing was Fickleman's 45's two-hour show on Saturday evenings. That is, until I heard that Danny Fickleman was about to retire. His last show will be, in case you're hearing it before then, June 25th. There was quite a story about him in the National Post of April 13th, sent on to us by Doug Copeland. Fickleman not only plays records from the 45 RPM era, but also interjects his comments, one might say rants, which I find amusing and often right on the mark. The article says, "I'm going to be 63 years old. I'm tired and I feel I'm running out of steam." That's quoting Fickleman. It's refreshingly rare to meet the performer who knows when to exit. But Fickleman's infamous hot air isn't completely exhausted. The rhetoric, as well as the R&B, classic rock and roll, won't actually cease until June 25th. The final show is supposed to be just like any other, except for a few goodbyes, but some of the shows leading up to it will not be from the studio as usual, but live recordings from a mini-tour of Ontario with onstage musings from Fickleman and live music by ex-Ray Charles sideman Doug Riley and others. For exactly when to listen to it online, check publicradiofan.com. I don't think Danny pretends to take requests as such, but a lot of radio shows do, playing music. Andy Kadir posts on the BDXC list in the UK this item: "No real listeners? Well, there you are doing a show, desperate to make the show sound as if the whole world is listening, but have run out of fake names to read out on air. Try this website. It will ensure you don't read the same name twice in a row. Now you know where all those unfamiliar names they read out on your favorite radio station come from. This is, I suppose, the difference between trying to sound professional and genuinely being a pro. Here comes the site, www.randomrequest.com. Let's proceed with some other references to fun stuff on the Internet. Hope you're ready to copy the URLs. If not, as I said, they're on the summary for this Continent of Media, 0504. Mark Nichols on Greyline DX from New Zealand says, "Here's an MP3 file you might want to listen and download. It's a promotional MP3 that includes a song called Jam Song, put out with an assortment of station IDs the company produced jingles for. You will recognize many U.S. and Canadian ones, even some from New Zealand, and even the Voice of America. It's www.jingles.com/audio/jamsong.mp3. If you were once a proud member, as I was, of the Newark News Radio Club, which is now long defunct, you might want to check out a blog which has been set up in its memory. Vinny, WB2KQG, says it's a virtual club blog, Newark News Radio Club .blogspot.com. Here's a website that lists all U.S. highways which have ever existed, not to be confused with interstates, but actual U.S. numbered highways. It could be of help if you just hear a mention of a highway on a meteor scatter burst or some other unidentified station. Thanks to Dave in Indy for posting this on the WTFDA list. It's www.us-highways, spelled the long way, .com/usbt.htm. Also in the WTFDA, Matt Sittle in Bellevue, Nebraska, says he has a new website packed with more DX, including his antenna setup and over 300 TV screen grabs of TVDX stations he's logged, and 100 from a previous stint in Tallahassee, Florida, some of them classics by now. And he plans to add DX audio files as well, and reports on his DX monitoring trips. And I suppose his unique page about the programming on various DTV channels is also there. It's www.mcsittel.com. I believe on a previous program I mentioned that ABC had suspended its news stream on a sub-digital channel, but now it's coming back. Thanks to Paul Armani in Denver for forwarding an AP story of April 4th that ABC News will relaunch its 24-hour digital news operation in July and continue to make ABC News Now available through the Internet and wireless devices. For the first time, the 10 ABC-owned stations will contribute local programming to the service, which ABC News President David Weston said would distinguish it from other national news providers. ABC will offer up to 50 hours of video on demand per month. ABC News Now will have a variety of short programs like the business show Money Matters around the opening and closing bells of the New York Stock Exchange and Politics Live with Sam Donaldson and Chris Cuomo. But for the most part, it will rerun other ABC News programming. Thanks to Brock Whaley for this from the New York Daily News, titled Fox News Host, Repeat After Me. If the conservative guests on Fox News, Hannity and Combs, sound especially on message, that's because they're being coached by the best, Sean Hannity himself. On the March 31st installment of the Shouting Head Show, the guests included two of the late Terry Schiavo's former nurses, arguing that their patient was not brain dead. Between commercials, according to an off-air audio tape obtained by investigative comedian Harry Shearer for his weekly radio program Le Show, Hannity coached the women on exactly how to respond when liberal co-host Alan Combs cross-examined them. Hannity can be heard instructing his guests, just say, I'm here to tell what I saw. No matter what the question, I'm here to tell you what I saw. I'm here to tell you what I saw. Hannity adds helpfully, say, I'm not going to be distracted by silliness. Look into the camera and look at me when I'm talking. And apparently that's exactly what they did. A Fox News flack did not respond to Lowdown's detailed message yesterday about this. I say, when will these so-called pros learn that they are always on during satellite backhauls? Such embarrassing things are a regular feature of Le Show with Harry Shearer, an hour which appears on a number of public radio stations and WBCQ, primarily on Sundays. Once again, check publicradiofan.com. If you seek some fitful entertainment, just try watching the captions on a live news broadcast. April 14th at 22:59 UT, NBC Nightly News closed as Nightly Fuse. Let me spell that. KNIGHTLYFUSE. That's what the National Captioning Institute showed. I kid you not. Is someone paying for this nonsense? If anything they should be able to get right, it's the title of the show. It's hard to imagine any business, except Microsoft, that could make so many mistakes and still keep going. However, captioning is not easy. Rich Cuff refers us to an article, a transcript of a piece on the public radio show Marketplace about this very topic, and it would appear to be a very good field to get into if you can stand the stress. Starting next year, virtually all TV programs will have to be closed captioned for the deaf and hard of hearing. That's job security for hundreds of trained stenographers who do the work. The problem is there aren't enough of them to meet the demand, says anchor David Brown, and the report comes from Kathy Duchamp in Seattle. It's about Cynthia Hill, stenographer, who's captioning local TV news from Phoenix. The national average salary for a broadcast captioner is $60,000 a year, but Hill says the fast talkers and long hours make for stressful work. On September 11, 2001, she started to caption at 4 in the morning and kept going right until midnight. It would take about 3,000 captioners to do the work required under the new federal law, and right now there are only about 400 people trained for this particular type of stenography. To narrow the gap, Congress has boosted funding for broadcast caption training programs like the one at Green River Community College in Auburn, Washington. Reporter Duchamp says many closed captioning companies don't require certification for employment. That's something you may have noticed when watching captions that are riddled with spelling errors or just plain gibberish. The National Association of the Deaf is lobbying the FCC to enforce quality standards. In Northeast Radio Watch for April 18th, Scott Feibisch says in New York City, we now know the parameters of the new facility that WFUV 90.7 wants to build to replace that ill-fated, uncompleted tower next to the Fordham University Stadium that created so much controversy with the neighboring botanical garden. WFUV has been granted a CP to move to the roof of an apartment building at 3450 Wayne Avenue in the Bronx, where it will run 45.8 kilowatts at 155 meters from a directional antenna, a considerable increase in height over its old licensed facility, which was 50 kilowatts at 66 meters atop a Fordham campus building. And another item from Feibisch's Northeast Radio Watch, this one March 14th, about Christopher Lydon's return to public radio. The former talk host on WBUR 90.9 in Boston will be hosting a show on WUML 91.5 at the University of Massachusetts in Lowell. But he'll be heard far beyond the Merrimack Valley. When Open Source debuts May 30th, it'll be produced at Boston's WGBH, which will also air the hour-long show Monday through Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern. Starting July 4th, Open Source will also be syndicated via Public Radio International, or whatever it's called now, which distributes WGBH's The World as well. And when new studios are ready at UMass Lowell in a year or so, Christopher Lydon will move production of this show there. Finally, a tip about a radio reading service, which has a program called Hobby Radio on Saturday afternoons. I've heard them reading a lot of articles from Monitoring Times. It's from the Radio Reading Service of the Rockies, Saturdays at 2030 UT. Go to www.rrsr.org and listen to the Boulder feed. Glenn Hauser concluding Continental Media 0504, also known as World of Radio Extra 58.